The next case on our calendar is 08780, Sheet Metal Workers International Association, Local Union Number 33 versus Jeans Refrigeration, Heating, and Air Conditioning. Mr. Ross.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'm Alan Ross. I'm here today along with Nick Nikolak from our law firm of Ross, Britton, and Schoenberg to represent Jeans Refrigeration in this really two-issue prevailing wage case which the court has taken up for consideration. The two propositions of law at some point intertwine. The first one deals with whether or not off-site manufacturing or fabrication of materials is covered by Ohio law based on what the appellee points to in an amendment to the prevailing wage law in 1935, which says in a phrase that the statute applies to any materials to be used in or in connection with a public improvement. The second issue deals with when does a labor organization, under what circumstances does a labor organization have standing to bring a complaint in a common pleas court. The essence of the ruling of the Ninth District on the first issue, that being the off-site fabrication issue, is that the legislature in 1935 overruled this court's decision in Clymer. That legislation superseded Clymer. The problem with that analysis is that if that were the case, then over the past 75 years that prevailing wage law has been in effect, there has never been any application of this prevailing wage law to off-site manufacturing or fabrication.
How do we know that? We don't have cases, but how do we know that in the business, in the industry, that there hasn't been some different application than you were suggesting? It does seem that there would have been, it seems like this would have been resolved within the industry, I guess. That's why I'm wondering.
Well, there's a couple of things that we can point to. And I can say from my own personal knowledge, back in 1990, we finally got around to drafting regulations. And I testified at those hearings that ended up in a set of regulations that went before JCAR. There isn't even a definitional section in any of the regulations that were passed that reference anything off-site. The idea of off-site fabrication work is never addressed at any point in those hearings that led to the passage of the administrative regulations. In performance of his duties under the prevailing wage law, the director of the Department of Commerce is supposed to issue a wage determination. Well, that wage determination is based only and solely upon contracts, collective bargaining agreements in the construction industry. And those rates only apply to construction contractors, only ever have. There has never been a rate determination issued by the director of the Department of Commerce or any of the predecessor agencies that addressed what is the prevailing wage in a county for steelworkers, members of the United Steelworkers Union, who might fabricate steel in order to cut I-beams, weld things onto I-beams to build this building. It's never happened. The only wage determinations that have ever issued have involved construction industry employers, and we do have, as Chief Justice may have implied in his question, some pretty clear understandings of what is in the construction sector and what isn't. Why that is important is because this court said in Evans versus Moore that the purpose of the prevailing wage laws in Ohio was to support the integrity of the collective bargaining process by preventing the undercutting of wages in the construction sector. That's found at page 92 of that opinion. As related to that, in Clymer itself, the first note in the syllabus at page 361 says that statutes that have penal consequences, which this does at 4115.99, must be strictly construed, and their scope cannot be extended beyond normal meaning of the terms that are used. Well, we all do have an understanding of what's in the construction sector. Those lines between what a fabricator and what a contractor are pretty well understood. Again, going back to the regulations themselves, we don't define supplier, fabricator, manufacturer in the regs themselves. There's only definitions of what is a contractor. In the statute itself, it refers to a contractor being responsible to pay prevailing wage and that it must impose those obligations upon its subcontractors. The statute does not say that we're going to also require the contractor to impose prevailing wage by way of the contracts that it enters into with fabricators or manufacturers.
Well, let me, just so we have a chance to explore the language, that's very difficult language, it seems to me. It's maybe somewhat inartful, but we have this language that was added to the statute, as you know. Prevailing rate of wages to be paid, this is 05, upon any workers or mechanics, upon any material to be used in or in connection with a public work. Now, that's really broad language. It seems to me, well, why don't you tell me why you believe, as you have said in your brief, of course, but why didn't the Court of Appeals here get it about as right as you can get it with this language? I mean, they tailored it, certainly, with this intimate connection language, which is not in the statute, obviously, but we have to do something with this language, don't we?
Yes, and I believe what we do with that language is we interpret this statute using two primary tools. One is that language must be read in pari materia with the statute and the regulations as a whole. And when we look at the statute as a whole, all that this statute and in turn the regulations refer to is work upon, about, or on the site of construction. And that is in part, I believe, Chief Justice, that is in recognition of the separateness of the construction sector that we talk about in Evans versus Moore and the fabricating and manufacturing sector. As related to that, under Ohio Revised Code Section 1.49, when there is an ambiguity, as you have just pointed out, with a particular sentence in a statute, well then, we look to what the administrative agency did. How did it interpret what that language meant? And here, we had months of hearings about what would go in those regulations. As representing an aspect of the construction industry, the Merit Shop contractors, I provided testimony, the union provided testimony through their attorneys, there was other testimony from the department, and then eventually the administrative agency wrote up regulations that don't even give us a definition of fabrication. That's their interpretation of the statute, let alone off-site fabrication. And in accordance with case law that we've cited in our brief, those interpretations of the statute should be accorded due deference by a court when trying to discern what the legislative intent could have been back in 1934. And I think there's really a third tool, and that is we cannot find a single common pleas court case, court of appeals case, no administrative published determination, which says anywhere for 75 years.
But see, that doesn't help us. The fact that there's a void in anyone speaking to the issue is here before us, and we have to make sense of this language. And your argument in your briefs is very persuasive that if the company goes and buys wood from the shelf at Lowe's and uses it in the construction or framing or whatever of a public project, perhaps the statute doesn't reach that far, but it seems to me there's a lot of fabrication or construction that occurs off-site, and then the parts are brought to the site, and that's my question. How do we just write out, just disregard the statute?
Because when we have a statute that's penal and must be strictly construed, and we can't tamper with normal, ordinary meanings, and we also have an administrative agency that's interpreted the statute and enforced it for 75 years and never said that the bench that you're sitting at, which you couldn't buy at Lowe's, could only have been made in a cabinet shop, especially for this job, the workers in that cabinet shop did not get paid prevailing wage to make this bench that you sit behind, but the workers that installed it on the site, yes, they got prevailing wage. All of the specialty items, all this ornamental bronze and what have you, that was especially fabricated for this job. It does have an intimate connection, but they're not construction workers. They're not working on site. The people that installed it would be paid prevailing wage. And the industry pattern, the industry practice, Chief Justice, also answers your question. None of those folks that made that bench, fabricated especially for this courtroom, that those bronze, whatever they are,
I hate to
they're
tell
not
it's
construction
gold leaf,
workers.
But it's all right.
I'm sorry?
I hate to tell you it's gold leaf, but
gold leaf, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to demean the decor of the courtroom. And so when you go down through, and I'll just do this briefly because I want to get to my other argument and leave myself a minute or two for rebuttal. When we look at what the regulations and statutes say at 4101, and then they're all -9-4, and then there's another number. So at 02GG, it defines a subcontractor as someone who performs work on the public improvement. At 9A, it talks about wages that are paid upon public works for work being performed on that public improvement.
Mr. Ross, you talk about strictly construing the statute, but it seems that you want to just delete upon any material to be used. Is that what you're suggesting, that it just be deleted? And can you say that deleting a phrase is a strict construction of a statute?
I'm not suggesting that you delete that phrase.
And how can it be interpreted?
That, number one, it's read imperi materia with everything else in the statute, and what that is talking about is any work upon the material, upon this bench, that's done here in this site, in this building, that is work that's been done upon that material, but it's on the construction site. It's not somewhere in Cincinnati where when the lumber's moved from the door to where they're going to build the bench, that's laborer's work, or is it some other union's work? And then the gentleman who does the mill work is carpenter's work, and then they have to use a crane because it's so big. Is that operating engineer's work? No, that's all work done in the fabrication shop, but it is work at the construction site upon material used in or in connection with any work done here.
So your strict construction would add the words upon any material on site.
Because that's what the rest of the statute speaks to. That's the only thing that the regulations speak to. It talks about an employee. Now we'll slide over to the standing argument here in a moment. Under 4115.10B, we're talking about the right of an employee to file a complaint. What employee can file a complaint? Any employee upon a public, any public improvement. Well, if we don't read the statute in peri materia, well then, and we're going to take that phrase, how would a somebody working in a fabrication shop who carried the lumber from point A to point B in the shop, how would he be able to make a claim under 4115.10B? He wouldn't be an employee upon any public improvement. He's back in the fab shop.
He could say I'm working on that improvement, couldn't he?
But the statute says upon.
I know, I've got a definition here of upon, and it's there. Even they're not very helpful, because upon sometimes is used in place of on. So it's difficult.
Even on. I mean, to me, on is it's here. It's not someplace else. On a public improvement is as used in this statute or about. They all mean here, in situ, at the site of the work. And I might add, and I understand what the court must do to ferret out, to make an interpretation of the statute, but with all due respect to opposing counsel and all the amici that sent in briefs here, no one presents any argument from the other side to address the in peri materia argument at all. No one addresses why these administrative regulations don't even give a definition of materials, don't give a definition of fabrication, don't give a definition of any of the terms that would be necessary in order to enforce this statute.
You've used your time, Mr. Ross.
I'm sorry?
You've used your time.
Thank you.
Mr. D'Angelo.
Mr. Chief Justice and Justices, good morning. I'm Joseph D'Angelo on behalf of the appellee in this case. And as has been indicated, there are two propositions of law here at issue. We've spent the vast majority of the time thus far this morning on the first issue. Let me simply clean up that point by saying we had a four-section statute. It was very basic. It only provided for rights upon a public improvement. The Supreme Court in Clymer versus Zane took up that language and said this is the language that defines the scope of the job. Promptly thereafter, as the Court of Appeals found in paragraph 33 of its decision, the legislature acted to add to upon the public improvement, which remains in the statute, but it also added work upon materials to be used. And what I find to be key, in addition to the fact that we have now two references of work that will trigger prevailing wage coverage, the one that was originally there and remains, is the locale of this work upon material seems to suggest that that locale may be different than the locale of the project site. You find that language in paragraph 6, although it's not separately subdivided, in section 5 of the statute, that the work upon material may occur at a locale other than the project is a pretty clear indication that it contemplates perhaps work being done in Cincinnati and then shipped up to the job site to be installed. And let's not forget factually in this case, we're dealing with a contractor who submitted a bid for a job. That bid was an HVAC contract that necessarily contemplated fabrication of ductwork by its own employees. This was all part of his bid. It was part of the contract price. And it's his own employees who were performing this work specifically for installation in the project. So the last point to make, I guess, is if you accept the Davis-Bacon analogy, which wasn't argued today, gratefully, because it wasn't raised below, but the Davis-Bacon formulation directly on the site is the exact parallel of upon a public improvement, which then gives no recognition whatsoever to paragraph 6, which adds upon material. So to take that application would simply collapse paragraph 6 into 1 and nullify the legislature's statement.
Is this the first case where a court has extended the statute to cover off-site work? Are you aware of any other case that has been?
I'm not, Your Honor.
So this is pretty much a first impression interpretation of the statute.
It is certainly the first time a court, including this court, has looked at the statute since Clymer, and the first time a court has looked at the statute with the existence of this new paragraph 6. even though it's 70-some years old.
And you concede that if we agree with your interpretation of the statute, it will have a massive effect on the construction industry.
I think the effect is large, but I also think that it was intended by the legislature. And I would also point out this intimate connection concept was actually first penned by the dissenting opinion of the Clymer Court. And as the Court of Appeals recognized at paragraph 37 of its decision, it seems as though the legislature adopted that concept when it enacted the new section in 1935 by using the to-be-used language. If something's manufactured and put in an inventory bin, it was built for anything. But when you take upon work specifically to be used in a public improvement, you know in advance of performing the work that that work is subject to a prevailing wage statute. I think that it easily avoids the larger implications of chasing down manufacturers of component parts.
Counsel, would that break point then include, for example, stone quarries in other places? For example, in a stone quarry, they blast out rock and then put it through a process to leave various sized stone on piles, some of which may end up in concrete or in a base at a public improvement project. How would you treat that under the interpretation that you're...
Certainly we have to engage in a series of different hypotheticals because it's beyond our case. But if I hear your question correctly, I would assume that when the rock is first blasted, it's inventory. There's no direction for that rock to go someplace certain. If it's piled but later sold, it seems to me once you have a certain amount of tonnage that's dedicated to a particular buyer on a public improvement, there would be a place there to draw that line. But the work taken to get it to the pile would not have been work contemplating public improvement. It would be outside the statute.
So the operator of the shovel that puts it on the truck that hauls it out to the highway project, for example, we use an incredible amount of stone, concrete, black mix, or blacktop, those kinds of things. You would see it as it falls under the statute when you get to the point where the operator at the plant is loading it onto transport to a job site.
I think that it could, and I'm afraid that the factual complexity of actually looking at that case, it makes it rather speculative to just say absolutely.
Okay.
Certainly, we've entered the realm where we know this particular material is now being dedicated to a public job, but how it gets from the pile to the job site may well introduce facts that would still render it beyond the reach of the statute or not. It depends on, again, one undertakes a contract with certain expectations of what their performance is, and that's kind of where you need to look to see whether the person knew or reasonably should have known his undertaking was encompassing.
And it seems like we're going to be dealing with gradations here because the sheet metal could have been fabricated on the job site.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Well, let's use this bench. An artisan could have been out in the hallway with the tools and fabricated the bench there, or could have more likely fabricated it back in a shop where all their tools are readily available and all of that. But it was specific, since that was the example, to this public location from start to finish. Commissioned work.
Yes.
So the line you would have us draw would be that when the materials have become site specific, that is, they're It is now known that they are destined for a public facility. Any work after that point has to fall within the prevailing wage.
Work performed after that material is to be put to that use. And again, allowing for the complexities that aren't in this case.
So the employees of this particular employer who offloaded sheet metal into an inventory or warehouse at the shop, that wouldn't be covered.
No, sir.
But the specifically dedicated employee who works on the metal that is now destined for the firehouse or wherever, whatever.
That's correct. The employee in this case worked in the fab shop. He formed the duct work specifically to the specifications of the fire station. They put it on trucks, hauled it out there. And the same happens, you know, when you frame buildings, for example. The examples are numerous. And again, you know.
Well, I think of a different example, and that is a lot of schools put in prefab classrooms when they were in a pinch. In my community, there are quite a few of them. So prevailing wage on those when they're back at the factory being fabricated, perhaps haven't. They're being fabricated in anticipation that some salesman is going to sell them to a school.
But
hasn't done so yet.
The exception here that school construction is excluded from prevailing wage, right. I can sidestep that question. Certainly, the same ruling thinking applies to the gravel. When it's part of the earth, it doesn't belong to anyone. And even when it's initially extracted, does not mean that it's committed. If a prefabbed facility is there for sale, it wasn't built for the school until the school bought it. Well, that work wouldn't be covered, assuming there was coverage. Okay.
Also, I want to ask you one other thing, because the language of the statute does, at least at first blush, appear to conform to your argument, but the fact that this hasn't been dealt with for some 70 years would reflect a general understanding of what the statute meant. Can you account for the fact that this hasn't been dealt with in rules or apparently practice for all this time, and yet it was still there, and as some have argued, apparently pretty obvious?
Well, I can say that this record doesn't permit us to make assumptions about practice and industry. There's no evidence in this record. This is a stipulated record. There is certainly no rule. But the first set of rules promulgated here wasn't until 1990. So even there, we're not really dealing with 70 years. But, you know, what the agency has done or what prevailing wage notices have been posted, you know, I mean, I can tell you.
All right, well, let's just go with the cases. Justice Pfeiffer pointed out the sort of complications or spinoffs that would occur with the ruling that you're urging. And the fact that none of those sort of close questions have ever come and appeared in a court case would indicate that this hasn't been used as the way that your interpretation would argue. And how do you account for that?
Well, there certainly is no litigation. I certainly can't argue that. I would point out that the dissenting opinion from the Ninth District, the problems posed are all assuming the all-or-nothing interpretation that appellant wants to give this language, in spite of the fact that the Ninth District specifically rejected that interpretation. But certainly there's been no case activity. I can't speak for the agency's activity. But I, you know, again, as we stand here, we see a very clear timeline and the presence of legislation that has yet to be spoken to by the court, and it's our obligation to find and effectuate the legislature's intent.
Is there anything in this record that would let us know what was included in the bid that was submitted by Jeans?
No, Your
Honor. As to whether or not there had been a prevailing wage for fabricators off-site?
No, sir. At this stage, I mean, we went from the pleadings to a set of stipulations that created the predicate to raise the legal issues and then briefs. I mean, there's no evidence beyond that. We haven't done any kind of an audit. We don't have any contracts or anything. But I can tell you from experience, certainly, if I bid an HVAC contract, I'm undertaking to provide you an HVAC system consistent with the specifications of your architect's drawing.
Well, of course, but anyone looking to submit that bid in conformity with what Justice Kupp was asking you about for the last 75 years had not incorporated into such a bid prevailing wage for the fabricators off-site, but had only incorporated prevailing wage for those at the site of the construction project and therefore formulated a bid for competitive purposes with the public agency. And so obviously, as was mentioned, dramatic implications if we transcend, and as Justice Pfeiffer suggested, this has a long tread of a number of roads substantially changing the size of those bids, I would suppose.
First point, all union contractors would in fact pay the prevailing wage even in the shop, because by their contract they're going to do the same work that Jeans did, but their shop employees by their contract get the same rate as their field employees installing. So I wouldn't agree that it's simply not done. So
this
that
may
way.
Not have such a dramatic effect.
That's correct.
Counsel, in that regard, and I've been exposed to the prevailing wage issues for a long time, going back to my service in the legislature, but it just occurred to me, I don't really know. If this employer's employees were all union members, is the wage that they have agreed to and the compensation that they get for their work at Jeans the same as the prevailing wage, or are those two different things?
With sheet metal specific, it would be the same, but I do know that there are, for example, shop carpenters,
yes,
with separate contracts. There's shop iron workers. They have separate rates, and it's conceivable that if an iron worker shop rate exists in the locality where the work's being performed, that may be the rate that would be applicable.
But that's the way the statute works. In other words, if they are a union member, whatever their compensation is as a result of their bargain that the union struck with the employer, that's going to be sufficient rather than looking at geographical interpretations of this is the prevailing wage for this.
That's correct. So, the determination.
So if their compensation as a union member at their employer is below what the average would be, or if you just looked at the prevailing wage for a determination, it would be the compensation that they actually receive.
Correct. The schedule itself at the very top will tell you the union contract that the rates are based from. If I can have
Mr. Darkangelo, on the standing issue, that's the concern that I have. If a single individual who has signed to have the union represent a single individual can therefore give the union standing in a case such as this?
And I thank you for that question. This to me seems to be the more radical divergence in my position from precedent of this court. Let me answer it this way as briefly as I can. I believe Section 3 creates standing to the extent of the persons who are given the statutory right to sue. Section 16 is the independent right of action that is then invoked by the persons giving standing. The has as members or is authorized to represent clause from Section 3F3 is only qualifying language that ties the particular labor organization to the public improvement. And I give you this as a proof of that. There's four different types of interested parties. They're all given equal standing under 16. So the only difference between them, it's not any contractor in the construction industry, it's only a contractor who bids for work. It's not any labor union, it's only a labor union who has as members employees of a person who bid.
But doesn't it say to represent employees, plural, not an employee? I mean, it doesn't suggest that a single employee would be sufficient, does it?
It doesn't. It does say employees. I agree with you. And I believe both opinions of this court in Mohawk recognize that Section 3 speaks very generally, and it is a general provision that makes sure the party asserting interested party standing has sufficient expertise to deliver an enforcement action correctly. So whether an employee or two employees, does that make the difference? In my view, the question really is, if an employee authorizes a union to act on his behalf, does the union then have sufficient nexus to that public improvement? Because Section 3 defines interested party with respect to the entire project. That gives the nexus necessary for the union to satisfy Section 3 and then go to Section 16.
But it seems here that we're talking about more than the interest of a single employee, are we not?
Absolutely. It is enforcement of the entire statute. And again, to pose why this has to be so, the fourth classification of interested party is an employer association. Now, an employer association who has members that bid the project, who are they representing? What if a bidder... Actually, there's a case published, Vaughn Industries versus Dimec. Vaughn bid and won a contract on the job and sued other contractors on the same job as an interested party. Who was Vaughn representing? The statute doesn't try to establish a representational capacity. The interested parties are those people who could be affected if other people don't play by the rules. And so what the legislature did was shift that type of enforcement into the private sector to assist the state. We have 15 investigators to cover the entire state of Ohio. And now we have interested parties. If a contractor feels he was slighted the contract because his competitor underbid, why, then he has standing under this action to go into Section 16 and enforce the law against that contractor. More often than getting authorization, the union's standing is established because a signatory bid and lost the job. In that case, the union doesn't represent anybody who touched a tool on the project, and yet there would be no controversy there that the enforcement goes forward based on the parties that were named.
You need to sum up, Mr. D'Angelo.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you. Mr. Ross, you used your time, but you may take 30 seconds. Start with that.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. First, with regard to the standing issue, I can only point to the Chief Justice's dissent as sort of the core point we want to make, and that is that this standing section is analogous to the appointment of an attorney in fact. If an employee does not, under the statute, give a union the right to represent him, he cannot have his right to be represented by his own legal counsel or to file a complaint with the department taken away. That's one of the reasons for the language in there. And as a matter of ethics, I again would quote the Chief Justice from the Mohawk case, and he says, "I trust we would not so easily change the meaning of authorized if a lawyer who has a right as a member of the Ohio Bar to represent a person in a court does so with no authorization by the person to act as the person's lawyer." I think once we let the union represent people who have not authorized them to represent them, by signing an authorization, and we had one here, and it was the man who worked in the shop, and we say that's another reason why there's no standing. Once we let any party represent individual employees without authorization, as is required, then we take away their right to due process and their right to select their own counsel. With regard to the impact of offsite fabrication on union contractors, you only need look at the Ohio Contractors Association, all the union heavy highway contractors, amicus brief, or the Associated General Contractors, which are the Union General Contractor Trade Association, and simply look at an example like guardrail, fabricated or not specifically fabricated for a highway project. Where does it ever end? It affects them as well. They also oppose this, which has been the law for 75 years. It will totally restructure every aspect of the construction industry in every detail. And finally, with regard to the ironwork, and, you know, that it would be an ironworker's rate that would fall into this. Well, wait a minute. Why wouldn't it be the United Steelworkers who represent the employees in that plant? Why does it have to be the construction industry rate? The United Steelworkers are going to go to the department and say, wait a minute, our rate applies. But unfortunately, our prevailing wage statute talks about the prevailing wage in a county. Well, there could be three United Steelworker organized companies in even in one county who all pay different rates.
Mr. Ross.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.